Okay, awesome. So hopefully this is recording. All right, I guess I'll welcome everybody again to Zoom version of RNA Club. Our first speaker today is Apple. She's from the Carpenter Lab, and she'll be discussing GapLink. Thank you. Go ahead and take it away, Apple.
All right, thanks for having me. Thanks for joining. As you can see, I've been trying to give this presentation since March, but I'm starting up all over again. So I'm excited to share my project with you. So to start, I wanted to give you some background on my project. So our lab studies the immune system, which has these two arms, and the innate and the adaptive immune system. And specifically, our lab focuses on the innate immune system, which is considered the first line of defense against pathogens. And in particular, we focus on these macrophage cells, and these macrophages are critical effectors of the immune system, effector cells of the immune system, and they detect or alert for the presence of pathogens. And how they do that is through these specific receptors that can recognize specific patterns. Here I'm highlighting TLR4. This recognizes LPS or lipopolysaccharide. It's a component of gram-negative bacteria. And in my later experiments, I'm going to be walking you through how we use LPS to turn on this inflammatory signaling cascade. Major factors to focus on is this transcription factor, NF-kappa-B. When it's activated, it'll translocate to the nucleus and initiate the transcription of inflammatory response genes. And so with any inflammatory response, it needs to be well-balanced. So we want to be able to contain that infection, eliminate the pathogen, but also resolve the inflammation, as a sustained immune response can damage the body, and this can lead to chronic inflammation, which is at the heart of many diseases. So let me highlight a few here. So cardiovascular disease, neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, autoimmune, chronic inflammatory diseases, and much more. And chronic inflammation, it's been well studied for many years. However, the bulk of our knowledge has come from studying just 3% of the genome that encode for protein. And as you can see here, a small part encodes for the protein, but the vast majority encodes for RNA that is non-coding. And to get a better understanding of the molecular mechanisms that are controlling inflammation, develop better therapeutics, we need to be studying more than just this small portion here. So what is the rest of this RNA doing? And so we study the largest class of non-coding RNA called long non-coding RNA. And for short, I'll be referring to these as link RNAs. So I'll tell you a little bit more about them. Like I said, they're non-coding, so they do not encode for protein. They're this arbitrarily signed over 200 nucleotides in length. They are processed similarly to mRNA, so they're capped, spliced, polyadenylated. They represent over a large percent of human and mouse genes, and yet less than 3% have a known function. However, of the link RNAs that have been characterized, several have been shown to control inflammation, specifically genes that can affect immune cell differentiation. So you see here this monocyte being able to differentiate into a macrophage, or the immune cell's effector function, so such as the chemical signals that they can be released to aid an immune response. And so here I want to introduce the focus of my project, which is called GapLink. It was previously characterized in gastric cancer, so that's why it stands for gastric adenocarcinoma predictive long energetic non-coding. And here I'm showing you how we identified GapLink, so in the context of inflammation. And so we started with RNA sequencing data, in which we isolated monocytes from human peripheral blood mononuclear cells, and then we differentiated these into macrophages using MCSF. And during this differentiation process, we looked for differentially expressed link RNAs, or long non-coding RNAs, that were either down or upregulated. And clearly, you can see GapLink was the most upregulated link RNA, so we kind of honed in on there. And as part of this pipeline, once we have a candidate, To better characterize it, we conduct functional or mechanistic studies. So either in vitro using cell culture models or in vivo using our animal models. So to characterize gap-link, we started with that classical knockdown experiment. Let's take it away using siRNA and then see what happens. And to remind you, gap-link was the most upregulated link RNA during macrophage differentiation. So we hypothesized that knocking it down would impact differentiation. And I want to credit Sergio for doing this part of the experiment. And so here I'm showing you a volcano plot, again, to show genes that are down or up regulated. And if we take all the genes that were upregulated and we do GO analysis, which simply tells you what biological processes are these genes involved in, you can see that the genes that were most impacted are not ones involved in differentiation. But if you read some of these terms, they're mostly involved in the inflammatory response. So this is very surprising because these are macrophage cells that have not been activated. You can see there's no treatment here besides knocking down gap-link. So these are at baseline. And because we form this connection to inflammation, we wanted to see what happens to gap-link and induce inflammation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
You also had some genes that went down also when you knocked down gap-link. Did they have any special functional GO term enrichment or anything? The -1 to -2 dots that are on your volcano plot.
So we knocked it down. What were the genes that were down regulated? We were pretty much trying to set this up for, we didn't have our CRISPR activation system up in place yet. So we're mostly focusing on genes that we can validate. But I don't think we've taken a closer look at the ones that have gone down and what biological processes those are involved in. And specifically because these align well with our mouse studies and those were most exciting. So I definitely need to go back and refresh myself on what those downregulated genes were. But we also plugged those into GoTerm and didn't see anything as interesting as this. Okay. Check on.
Yes, please do. I turned my mic off because you had answered it so completely. Go ahead, please.
I see faces right now, so it's a little unnerving. I just see my screen. Okay. So we knocked it down. We saw that it turned on inflammation. So we next wanted to ask, okay, well then what happens now if we induce inflammation? So we again isolated monocytes, differentiated them into macrophages, and then we added LPS to these cells. And as you can see, the expression of gap-link upon LPS stimulation was rapidly downregulated. And so the next question we wanted to ask is, well, how is that being regulated? And so we turned to ATAC-seq. And just a quick overview of what this assay means. This assay allows us to see open regions of chromatin. And so you have this enzyme, TM5, that will preferentially incorporate into these open regions of chromatin. And it'll cut and simultaneously ligate these adapters for sequencing. And then these sequencing reads are then mapped to a reference, and then where these reads piled up, you'll see these peaks here, which will represent those open chromatin, where the area was accessible by that enzyme. And so in monocytes, where gap-link is not expressed in, you see that this region, we see no peaks here. In our differentiated macrophages, under baseline, no stimulation, you see these nice peaks. And then upon LPS stimulation, you see that it's tightly shut down. And so this matches up with our previous data where we see that downregulation of gap length occurs upon LPS treatment, and now we see that this is being regulated at the level of chromatin. And what also made gap length an interesting candidate was that it appeared to be conserved in mouse. So for conservation in link RNAs, we look at syntenic conservation. Essentially, are the neighboring protein coding genes conserved? So in human, gap length is found between TGIF1 and DLGAP1. And in mouse, these genes are conserved, they're just inverted. But we wanted to ask, is there something in the middle here that will recapitulate some of our human findings? And so to remind you, in human, gap link is expression increases during differentiation. And I saw that in bone marrow derived macrophages as well, comparing differentiated macrophages to bone marrow cells. And then if I repeat the experiment with LPS stimulation, I see that expression of gap link is also downregulated. And so we see that this expression pattern between human and mouse is consistent, which suggests that perhaps the regulation in both human and mouse may be the same. And so with that, we wanted to take this even further. So we generated a gap link knockout mouse using CRISPR-Cas9. A brief summary, these are all the guides that were targeting these different regions. All these guide RNAs were co-injected into a pseudopregnant female to generate founder mice, which I then backcrossed to wild type and then bred them to homozygosity. So for these next experiments, I'm just confirming this is the resulting knockout that we achieved with that CRISPR-Cas9. You can see we cut out exon 1, a large portion of the intron, but retain exon 2. And to confirm this is a knockout, purified genomic DNA from mouse tails. This is just one of the primer sets to detect the wild type in a knockout. So a wild type would have roughly 1,700 base pairs in like amplicon, and then a knockout would be roughly around 500 base pairs. So you can see that here. And then I also confirm, because I'm working with macrophages, I also confirm this knockout in BMDMs. And so I use primers targeting exon 1, exon 2, and then some spanning the exons. And you can see that for exon 1 and the exon spanning primers, where this region has been deleted, it's undetectable in the knockout. And then we see a little bit of transcript coming from the knockout for exon 2, which is what was retained after the deletion. And so we wanted to ask, what did this knockout do globally? So we wanted to compare the transcriptome of our wild type and our knockout mouse to determine what genes were affected with just the knockout alone. And to remind you, that major phenotype we saw when we knocked down gap link in human was at baseline. So we're repeating the same experiment here. So harvesting bone marrow cells, differentiating them into macrophages, doing RNA-seq, and then differential expression analysis. And so as you can see, the gap link knockout upregulated inflammatory related genes, similar to what we saw in human. And again, if I take those genes that were upregulated and do GoTerm analysis, you'll see there's like over 100-fold enrichment in IL-6 production. We get NF-kappa-B signaling, cytokine production. And so, this is very similar to what we saw in humans. So taking out gap link or depleting it in some way seems to turn on inflammation. And so now that we generated these knockout mice, we wanted to challenge them using one of the investigative tools we use in the lab, which is an endotoxic shock model. And this is what we use to measure response to LPS, or that lipopolysaccharide. And so, to induce endotoxic shock, we take the wild type and our knockouts and we inject them intraperitoneally with LPS. And then we measure percent survival and we ask ourselves, are we going to see a difference? Like, will there be changes? Will these graph lines be similar or will they be different? We're not quite sure. And so before going to my experiments, I wanted to give a brief overview on how this model is being used to address sepsis, which is a highly prevalent condition, as you can see as it's defined here. It's a life-threatening condition that is caused by an excessive immune response to an infection. So there's this imbalance, and this imbalance can lead to organ failure and death. And really simply, you'll get this drop in blood pressure, reduced oxygen supply, which could then lead to increased coagulation. And then this cuts off oxygen, this cuts off that oxygen supply, so then you get organ failure. And the mortality rate for sepsis is still pretty high. Based off the CDC statistics, 1 in 3 patients who die in a hospital have sepsis. And in the last 3 decades, you know, the standard of care has not changed. It's just pump you with fluids, give you lots of antibiotics. And so we definitely need better therapeutics. And so going back to that survival experiment, we injected again our wild type and our knockouts with this LPS. And you can see that after just 1 day, the majority of our wild type mice succumb. This is surprising because the 5 mg/kg is considered sublethal, but we're actually seeing 0% survival after 2 days in our wild type. But if you see here, when we challenge our knockout mice, we are getting 100% survival at this dose compared to wild type. So somehow our knockout mice are resistant to this LPS-induced endotoxic shock. And so, of course, our question is, well, how are they surviving? And then to remind you, this endotoxic shock model, you know, you'll have this increase in coagulation leading to this multi-organ failure. And so based on this phenotype we were getting, we wanted to measure differences in coagulation. And so to do that, we employed this test called APTT to measure time to clot formation. And this is a little counterintuitive, but the way this is measured is that if a sample is more coagulated, then it's already undergone that coagulation cascade. So it's depleted those factors. And so if you induce clotting, it's going to take a lot more time to form a clot. Okay, if it's already been coagulated, used up stuff, not enough of it, so it'll take more time. On the other hand, if a sample was originally less coagulated, those factors are readily available, so the time to form a clot is going to be much less. And so if I use this test to measure differences in coagulation upon LPS challenge in my mice, what I see here, you can see that the wild type are taking roughly 30 seconds, and the knockouts a little about 25. And so you can see the wild types are more coagulated because they're taking more time to clot using this assay. And so this increased coagulation in the wild type confirms for us those drastic differences in the survival rate. So our wild type mice are undergoing that organ failure. And so just confirm that the survival phenotype is just a consequence of organ failure due to that increased coagulation. However, we really still have answered, like, what are the contributing factors to this survival phenotype? So we look back on our RNA-seq data, and to remind you, when we knocked out GAPLink, it upregulated these inflammatory genes at baseline. And so what I did is I looked at the 23 genes that were upregulated upon a knockout, so they're shown here in red, and focusing on these genes, the ones in red here, I wanted to ask, well, how do the wild type and the knockout then compare once I add LPS to them? And surprisingly for us, they, after stimulation, they were comparable between wild type and knockout. They reached several similar levels of expression. But because these inflammatory genes in the knockout are already starting at a higher level at baseline, when we compare the full change in induction for inflammatory response genes, and I'm showing you the top 100 upregulated genes in response to LPS, we see that there's this drastic difference where the full change in the knockout after all, pH challenge is smaller in the knockouts compared to wild type. And we think that this decreased induction may be contributing to that survival phenotype. Okay, so going back to the RNA-seq, we wanted to compare then what genes are conserved and impacted from RNA-seq in both the human and the mouse. And we found that this overlap of genes are involved in NF-kappa-B signaling. And actually, many of them are direct targets of NF-kappa-B. So my next steps were to test if the signaling was affected at different stages. And so to remind you again of that signaling pathway, we're focusing on this major transcription factor, NF-kappa-B, and the most abundant form of NF-kappa-B activated by LPS is this P65-P50 heterodimer. And so in the classical NF-kappa-B signaling pathway, these subunits, they're held in the cytosol by this inhibitor, and during activation, this inhibitor gets phosphorylated, which then leads to its ubiquitination and degradation, which releases P50, P65 to move to the nucleus and then activate target genes. And so what I wanted to ask first is, are there differences in that inhibitor degradation? And so comparing wild type and gap-link knockout BMDMs over an LPS time course, you can see that the levels of this inhibitor are comparable between the wild type and the knockout. And I've quantified this here. So there's no differences in the degradation of this inhibitor. So kind of continuing on this signaling pathway, well, if there's no differences in the inhibitor degradation, what about in total P65 levels? Okay. And so we did, initially, I didn't think the knockout affected P65. Again, this is one of those subunits of NF-kappa-B, so I'm using them interchangeably. So from our RNA-seq data, we see that the FPKM values for wild type and knockout BMMs are comparable at both basal and at LPS. However, if I look at the protein level, using Western blot, then I see that there is a significant difference in the total P65 levels, and that's quantified here. And to give credit, this is one of my undergrads that did this Western here. And so far in the signaling pathway, I see no differences in the degradation of the inhibitor, but I do see an increase in total P65 here. So P65, right, has this ability to translocate to the nucleus. So I wanted to ask, okay, well, where is this increase in P65 located? So I took my bone marrow-derived macrophages and I separated out the cytoplasmic and the nuclear compartments to assess P65 levels. And because my knockout was turning on immune response genes, right, as if they're being activated, I wanted to see if there were differences in this translocation of P65 from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. And so here I'm showing you levels of P65 in the nuclear compartment, comparing wild type and knockout mice. And as you can see, there is a significant difference where the knockouts have more abundant P65. And this was really exciting for us because I was starting to see gap link affecting levels of this, you know, major transcription factor. So of course, my next question was like, is gap link directly interacting with P65? And so I did a RNA immunoprecipitation to check if there's an interaction, direct interaction between gap link and this NF-kappa-B subunit. And so first I checked to make sure my wild types and my knockouts had P65 in its input. I confirmed in my IP that I was able to successfully pull P65 out of my samples. But unfortunately, if I look at the enrichment of gap-link for any of these pull downs, it suggests to me that gap link is not interacting with P65. It would have been great, but that's not what's happening in the story here. And so to wrap up my talk and kind of just lead off into what my next steps, obviously the first one is, who is gap link interacting with? What are the binding partners? That's one I've been having a very difficult time finding. The other question we're asking, is this mechanism macrophage driven, so from the bone marrow? And so I've been getting some help from Stephanie in the Forsberg lab, where we're doing these transplantation assays where we're taking the bone marrow out of our wild types and our knockouts and transplanting them into OJ recipients and then repeating that LPS challenge to see if we'll still continue to have a survival advantage. And then lastly, I've made a knockout mouse. I've also made a transgenic gap-link mice, which expresses gap-link at the H11 locus. And I'm currently crossing them. I had some help genotyping from another undergraduate lab this summer. And so I'm on that F3 where I've now obtained homozygote. So I have homozygote transgenic on the H11 and a knockout on the endogenous chromosome 17 gap link locus. And so that next litter is gonna be really fun to kind of see if I could rescue that phenotype here. So I'm at 30 minutes, but Susan's going to continue this talk on link RNAs. So if you're excited about this, she's giving one tomorrow, so go check it out. And then I will end here and thank my lab and all the collaborators. Yeah, so I hope I didn't go over too much time. I might be able to answer some questions if anyone has any. And I will stop sharing so I can see your faces.
Thank you, Apple. That was an awesome talk. So does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, where's the pizza?
Yeah, I was trying to convince Harry to deliver pizza all over town to everybody, but he didn't quite go for it.
Apple, I have a question.
All right.
You were talking about a model for sepsis where you basically the gap link knockout mice, I think I got that right, survived longer than the wild type. How does that compare to known factors? And is it explainable as just a like hypo-inflammation response? Like they can't do inflammation and that's apparent, that might be a good thing in a sepsis paradigm? Or is there like something that's specific to sepsis in that that you think is going to be informative?
So I focused in on, is it a hypo? So one of the pieces of data I showed is that if we challenge the wild types in their knockouts with LPS, they do reach the same level of cytokine expression levels. And so they are reacting. There's no differences in the amount that they're going to. And then the first part of your question, what is one of the known genes that would
How does that compare to known factors that are involved in sepsis or required for sepsis?
Yeah, so we know TLR knockout mice have the same surprising phenotype because you take out the receptor. At this dose, not to be misleading, but at this dose, we do see that huge survival difference. But if I increase the dose to, say, from a 5 mg per kg to 20 mg per kg, then all the mice will die, but I will still retain like a 4-hour survival advantage. So the known gene I know that mimics this is just knocking out that TLR4 receptor.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if there's other branches of this signaling pathway that don't go towards NF-kappa-B from that receptor, but goes somewhere else. It sounds like you have a strong biological effect, but the standard known signaling pathways and molecules aren't really changing in your system. So it must be some other pathway or some other component that's providing the protection. Do I have that?
Some other pathway that's providing protection.
Well, you have, if I understood, you have the same cytokine response and so on, right, in the knockout, but the mice don't kick.
The mice, yes.
They don't die, right?
Die, no.
but they are having all the other cytokine induction events and so on. So what I guess I'm saying is, like, if I guess the model was that those things can, that reaction, that cytokine reaction can kill you, but it's happening and they're not being killed. So what's killing them, I guess, if it's not that?
What's the wild types?
Yeah, what's kill, because you, yeah, because the mutants aren't dying, but the wild type are being killed by something, and your gaplink is doing the thing that's creating the killing effect. But what is the molecule that's creating the killing effect? What are the molecules? They're not the ones that are the known standard response, if I understood what you're saying.
So what's doing the killing? So we just know that they're more coagulated. We know that the levels that they reach are the same. It's I showed that the fold change is different because the knockouts are already inflamed. So when they are stimulated with LPS, they go to the same levels, but they're already starting at a higher level. And so that fold change is much smaller. So maybe that's less of a shock for the knockouts.
And okay, yeah, I see. So it's a matter of degree. So what is the, if you, when you differentiate from monocytes to macrophages, gaplink is off in monocytes and it is then highly expressed in macrophages. Mm-hmm. And then it goes off when you stimulate. I'm just curious if you block gaplink accumulation during monocyte differentiation, do you get macrophages that just aren't responsive? Is that what? They would be hyper responsive, right? In other words, if you made a macrophage that didn't have gap by differentiating into the macrophage, or I don't even know if, does it differentiate normally into a macrophage without expression of gap link?
So that was one of our concerns, if we knock out gap link, because it's highly increases during differentiation, does it affect differentiation? So I did do a flow cytometry experiment where I assessed for the macrophage markers, and they are differentiating like normal. Oh. And then answer your question about, are they still functioning the same? Macrophages like to eat and phagocytose. So we have done phagocytosis assays between our wild type and our knockouts to confirm that the function is the same. And so they're not impaired in macrophage function either. They're able to release the same amount of cytokines. So they're acting like macrophages. So in terms of differentiation and function, the knockout is not impacting that.
Okay.
Apple, are your gaplink knockout mice, are they just like inflamed all the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Knock it out there. So when you knock it out, you'll see expression of IL-6 induced, but it'll be maybe like threefold versus a thousandfold when you actually add LPS. So they're slightly inflamed, not as much as if you're challenging them directly with that LPS, but they're slightly inflamed.
So if they don't get any kind of LPS challenge, do those mice not live as long? Have you been able to do, I know longevity studies cost a lot, but have you been able to just like let them run and see if they, you know, because chronic disease or chronic inflammation is killing, you know, kills humans.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really kept them over, I would say, a year, but we're definitely like on F15 generation. We've been breeding them since like second year of grad school, so. They've been there for a while, and we've also have the transgenic. Those are looking normal too. So whether we're knocking it out or overexpressing it, the mice seem fine.
Cool.
Any other questions for Apple before we move on?
Apple, sort of off of Jesse's question. If you challenge the mice with LPS, have you seen any accumulation of tumors or anything like that that might suggest that the inflammation might increase tumorigenicity in any way?
No, we haven't looked at that. How would I know if they're producing?
Yeah, that's a good point. So if you would just palpate the mice, for example, oftentimes you can see like breast tumors, something like that. The truth is you would have to be looking, for them.
I mean, we've taken organs from both wild types and knockouts. I haven't seen anything that looks abnormal between the two mice.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, Apple, this is John. One question I had is, have you tried any, like the inverse of a RIP, like RNA affinity chromatography, to see any other proteins that may be associated with gap link in the context of your cells?
No. So the only thing then to try to figure out binding partners, if we have a candidate in mind, like P65, I've done RIP, and then I've done the other way where I've tried to do chirp and pull down on my endogenous RNA, kind of go fishing with that and see what comes down, and ID by mass spec, but we have not been able to find anything on there. I'm not really familiar with the assay you mentioned.
Well, I'm more in the context of using the RNA as the, you know, the bait and then trying to pull out proteins.
Yeah, I've done that many, many times. I've done that like in primary human, primary mouse, our CRISPR activated systems. I've tried it many, many times. We're just not picking up a candidate.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. I think that's my time. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you again, Apple. I guess we could all clap silently. okay. So everybody can hear me, right? My face isn't popping up on my screen for some reason, but that's okay. Parisa, are you here? Do you want to share your screen and we can get you introduced? Thank you all for all the great questions too. I was a little worried if the communication was going to be a little bit of a barrier with Zoom, but so far the discussion is still happening, so appreciate that.
Okay. Can you see this?
Yeah, looks good.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so again, thanks Apple, and we're going to be shifting gears a little bit. So this is Parisa from the Arabear Lab, and she'll be discussing ribosome collisions today.
Cool. Thanks, Allie. If any of you have questions while I'm going, you're welcome to unmute yourself and just start talking, because I can't see the chat or your faces or anything while I'm doing this. So I'm Parisa, and today I'm going to tell you about some of the things that can happen when ribosomes run into each other. And first, here I'm showing you a cool cryostructure of two collided ribosomes with mRNA and tRNA in red, and the large subunits darker and the small lighter. And it's really cool that this trailing one is just rotated on its side, which doesn't happen normally. And I just wanted to share this with you. And so, first off, why does it matter if ribosomes run into each other? So, as I'm sure you're aware, ribosomes are essential because they produce all the cell's proteins, and it's crucial that they can initiate and properly decode and terminate and release the protein. If they move too fast or too slow or bump into each other, that can impair these important steps and cause issues. In normal translation, ribosomes read the mRNA one codon at a time as they build the peptide, and once they reach the stop codon, the ribosome and peptide are released, and the mRNA can continue engaging in more rounds of translation. However, sometimes subtle errors occur during transcription or mRNA processing, and these go unnoticed in the cell until they're detected by a ribosome that's passing by. Some of these errors can be stable secondary structures like a stem loop or stretches of difficult or rare codons. Ribosomes could also pause while translating to allow for proper folding of the peptide or as a way to regulate gene expression. However, if the stalled ribosome, the first ribosome, remains here for too long, it can act as a roadblock to trailing ribosomes, which could eventually occur. A collision could eventually occur if these ribosomes bump into each other. And one pathway that's known to deal with collided ribosomes is known as no-go decay. No-go consists of mRNA cleavage and decay, ribosome rescue, and degradation of the nascent peptide. And while no-go is one pathway that we know of that is induced by collisions, there are also likely other mechanisms which may not lead to these decay steps. And so one factor that we know about that recognizes collisions and signals no-go is the ubiquitin ligase, ZNF598. The current model considers ZNF as one of the first responders to ribosome stalling. However, it may not be the only way to detect these stalled ribosomes. Recent studies have found that ZNF ubiquitinates ribosomes on at least three different ribosomal proteins. However, the field still doesn't know what the roles are of these specific ribosome ubiquitination events. And that's what I'm primarily going to focus on today. And so for over a decade now of studying no-go decay, it's only been ever studied in yeast and human cells. This has limited the scope of the field, namely in its ability to identify new factors and to identify genetic interactions between known factors. So to address this problem, our lab has been establishing C. elegans as a new system to study no-go and also study other related translation-dependent decay pathways. And so this has already paid off with Marissa's recent discovery of the first known nuclease involved in no-go, known as NONU1. And I just wanted to acknowledge all the work that Marissa did to find NONU, and I'll talk more about NONU later. And so, as NONU as a prime example, worms have allowed us to do this because, unlike most metazoans, deletions of a lot of translation surveillance and mRNA decay machinery are viable. And this makes worms a genetically tractable system to study no-go. And so, because worms are fast-growing, hardy animals, and thanks to the development of CRISPR by these two women in science, I can do things like easily make point mutations in factors of interest, delete multiple factors at once, edit and even add tags to the ribosome, and observe phenotypes of these mutations in a multicellular animal. And so using this system, I'm going to show you how I've answered some of these following questions. The first being, can I observe no-go in worms, given that we're the first to actually try to induce no-go in this organism? And so to do this, I made this reporter, which uses GFP as a measure of the expression of the C. elegans protein UNC54, which is a myosin protein. After UNC54, there's a T2A self-cleaving peptide, which results in two separate proteins, allowing some UNC54 protein to escape degradation while the mRNA is still targeted. And for this reason, my reporter specifically studies mRNA decay. Then I have a flag tag, which will allow the ribosomes to resume elongation before they encounter the difficult sequence. Then I have 12 arginine codons upstream of GFP, which are expected to stall ribosomes with empty A sites. And these arginines are considered rare because their cognate tRNAs are present in the genome at a low number, so they are decoded more slowly than their more common counterparts, thus making ribosomes pause for longer. And I alternated between these two codon so that the sequence would be mappable later on. So now you may be asking why I'm using arginines. That's because in eukaryotic ribosomes, the exit tunnel is negatively charged. This typically doesn't cause a problem during translation because there's so few positively charged amino acids. But if a message contains a long stretch of positively charged residues, this could have a high affinity for the exit tunnel and clog up the tunnel, which poses a challenge for translocation. And there's a lot of evidence that this is the case in yeast, and so I went forward with arginines. And sure enough, 12-ver arginines effectively repressed this reporter expression compared to the equivalent with lacking the arginines. And so from this result, I concluded that arginine-induced no-go decay occurs in worms, and I now had my first tool to study the pathway. And so yes, rare arginines can induce no-go repression. Next, knowing that I had a clear readout of no-go, I was ready to investigate the role of ribosome ubiquitination in mRNA repression. So I mentioned earlier that ZNF598 is a collision-sensitive factor which signals no-go via ribosome ubiquitination. My first step was to functionally identify the ZNF homolog in worms. And at the sequence level, ZNF598's major domains are well conserved. In yeast, humans, and worms, it contains a ring ubiquitin ligase domain, which mediates ubiquitin transfer. And I have highlighted here the major residues that define this as a ring domain. And also in all three organisms, there are three zinc fingers conserved, and which may bind RNA or may do other things because zinc fingers can do a lot. And I also want to highlight this kind of bizarre proline-rich C-terminus that is mostly present in humans and worms. And it's notable because prolines are difficult during translation, which raises a lot of possibilities of why ZNF598 has kept this stretches of prolines, but that's for another day to talk about. So that's all well and good. ZNF is conserved at the sequence level, but now I needed to test its function in worms. And so to do that, I used a ZNF deletion allele and my rare arginine reporter from before. And you can see here, there's strong derepression of the reporter in the ZNF delete, indicating that ZNF is in fact the functional homolog in C. elegans and is required for no-go mRNA repression. And so next, I wanted to more specifically nail down the function of ZNF. And other groups have shown that this conserved cysteine at the beginning of the ring domain is required for ubiquitin transfer in human cells. And so I substituted the C89 with an alanine. And as you can see here, no-go is reduced to the same level as seen in the ZNF delete. And this indicates that ZNF's repressive function lies in the ring domain, specifically through its ubiquitination of something. But what does it ubiquitinate? And so this question has come up several times in recent years. By incubating purified ZNF with mammalian ribosomes, the Hegde lab found that it's able to primarily ubiquitinate RPS10 and also RPS20 and RPS3, but at a much lower level. And while we know that it's able to ubiquitinate these, we don't actually know the roles of these ubiquitination events, and we don't know which ribosome actually receives the ubiquitin at the stall. However, I was thankful to know that some targets were identified, and so first I pursued RPS10 because it had the strongest signal. And so as to be expected with a ribosomal protein, it's very highly conserved between the human and C. elegans. And This lysine here was identified as the ubiquitination target in humans and turns out to be among the many conserved residues in worms. And so I went forward with lysine 125. So ubiquitin ligases need specific lysines to add ubiquitin. And so I mutated this lysine to an arginine to prevent ubiquitination of RPS10. And upon introducing the rare arginine reporter, I saw mild derepression, indicating that K125 on RPS10 is important for no-go, but some no-go can still happen without its ubiquitination, which agrees with the literature that other residues or other proteins on ribosomes are also getting ubiquitinated, but which steps of no-go can still occur without RPS10. And so while K125 is clearly involved in no-go, I wanted to get a clear readout of its ubiquitination. And so to do this, I added a tag to RPS10 and did a Western blot to see if I could see a shift in size that would confirm a ubiquitination event. And I saw a band exactly where I expected to see a ubiquitinated RPS10. This was very surprising for me to see, because other groups to actually get this signal induce stalling in some way, but I just did this in regular old worms with no stalling, which leads me to believe that the adding a tag to the ribosome must somehow negatively impact its movement, which is a question that I'm eventually gonna look into more, but I thought it was really cool that I actually could see the ubiquitination shift. And then to test if this actually was a ubiquitinated species, I used the ZNF598 ring domain mutant I showed you earlier. And sure enough, the higher weight band that I see here disappeared in the ZNF ring domain mutant, which supports the hypothesis that a ubiquitinated RPS10, that this band is a ubiquitinated RPS10, and that the ligase function of ZNF is responsible for its formation. And so given these results, I can say that ribosome ubiquitination is necessary for efficient no-go, and that RPS10 ubiquitination alone is not enough to signal full repression. And so now that I've established the tools I need to study ribosome ubiquitination, I wanted to go beyond the previous literature and test whether certain no-go factors are recruited via these marks.
Can I just ask a quick question before you leave that?
Yeah.
Did you try any anti-ubiquitin antibodies for your Western?
So I have tried that. The antibody that we have, it seems to have gone off or doesn't work for some reason, so I got a new antibody which I'm about to test to confirm like that this is actually ubiquitin.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's a logical thing to do.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. And so first I'm gonna loop back now to NONU1 that I mentioned before. Right now, NONU is the only identified endonuclease that functions in no-go. And through a suppressor screen, Marissa found NONU and went on to identify that it's a nuclease responsible for cleavages near stalled ribosomes. And it's composed of a P-loop kinase domain, which may phosphorylate RNA, notably two ubiquitin binding domains, and an SMR nuclease domain. And to test if NONU actually cleaves mRNA at a stall, I previously performed ribosome footprinting on a rare arginine reporter, very similar to the one I used for my fluorescence stuff I showed you earlier. Ribosome footprinting lets me capture and sequence ribosome-protected mRNA fragments, and we know that a ribosome normally protects 28 to 30 nucleotides of RNA, And so I'm using shorter footprints of 15 to 18 nucleotides as a readout of a cleavage inside of a ribosome. And it's important to note that when I do this protocol, I have to do it in a background that lacks the means to rescue ribosomes so that the footprints remain intact for library prep. And so here's a look at the footprints near the arginines. In green are full footprints, depicted like by this ribosome here. And in yellow are short footprints that are indicative of a cleavage, like depicted here. And so there's an accumulation of yellow short footprints upstream of the arginine. And that those footprints go away when I delete the SMR nuclease domain of no new one. And instead, those footprints are remain as full footprints in the no new mutant. And so this is evidence that no new one is required for cleavages upstream of the rare arginines. And we'll come back to this data in a second. Oh yeah, and that's, these footprints remained as large. And so now given that result, I expected to see derepression of my similar fluorescent arginine reporter. And so to test this hypothesis, I used a nuclease domain mutant that substitutes this aspartic acid with histidine to alanines, which I will call AXA. And in this AXA mutant, I saw moderate derepression of the reporter, indicating that no-new's nuclease function is necessary for efficient no-go. But it's important to note that its derepression just pales in comparison to the ZNF delete, which made me ask what else is functioning in no-go in addition to no-new one. And then in addition to that difference between the no-new mutant and the ZNF mutant, the two together here show the same level of derepression as the ZNF mutant alone, which raises the question, does ribosome ubiquitination recruit an endonuclease, such as no-new one? And so going back to the footprinting data in light of the fluorescence data I just showed you, we can also see that there are short footprints within arginines that appear to be no new one independent. This suggests at least one unidentified nuclease acts along with no new one at the stall and cleaves near ribosomes more downstream. A second nuclease could explain why the no new one mutant resulted in less derepression compared to the ZNF delete. And given that ZNF's primary function is to ubiquitinate ribosomes, and that it functions upstream of no new one, I plan to do ribosome footprinting again to see if in a ubiquitination mutant, if these no new one dependent footprints stick around to determine if no new one cleavage depends on ubiquitination. And so I can start to answer my third question here, if no-go factors recognize ubiquitinated ribosomes, with a yes, at least for no-new one, that my data now suggests no-new one may be recognizing ubiquitinated ribosomes. And that may happen in a model similar to this, where ZNF598 ubiquitinates ribosomes at the collision interface, possibly to recruit no-new one or other nucleases via the ubiquitin marks and via no-new one's Q domains. And to summarize some of the things I told you about these two factors, ZNF598 is required for efficient no-go and ubiquitinates RPS10 as well as likely other sites on ribosomes as its primary function. And no new one is required for cleavages at stalled ribosomes, works downstream of ZNF598, supporting a model similar to this, and functions alongside other unidentified nucleases. So going forward, I have three main questions that I'm gonna show you here. What else is functioning in no-go in addition to no new one? And so I'm currently doing a no-go suppressor screen. It's very similar to the one that Marissa did for a like related translation pathway that discovered no new one. And so the screen looks something like this, where I take animals expressing my reporter, which can't move. I expose them to a mutagen, and then I look for animals that can move and that glow green, like the images I showed you earlier. And then as part of the screen, I want to avoid hits in ZNF-598. This is because I did a preliminary screen several months ago, and the vast majority of the mutants I got were in ZNF-598, which, I mean, it was so bright. It seems like it's very important in the pathway, so I'm not surprised I got it so many times, but they're not super informative anymore at this point. So I've altered the screen to avoid ZNF-598, and this is briefly how I did it. ZNF-598 is right here, and I have a allele here that when homozygous is sterile, and a balancer here that also when homozygous is lethal. And so if I get a mutation in one copy of ZNF-598 and it recombines to become homozygous, it would be lethal and I won't recover those mutants. And so I'm literally doing this right now, and it's nice to see that I could get some mutants that aren't recessive ZNF mutants. My other question is to tease apart the roles of these various ubiquitination sites on ribosomes. One question is, RPS10 required for no-go? For RPS20, is ZNF-598 required for the ubiquitination of RPS20? And would a mutant of both of these ribosomal proteins match a ZNF-598 mutant, which would suggest these are the only proteins that it ubiquitinates? And last, I want to figure out if cleavages by no new one upstream of arginines are ubiquitin dependent. So like I showed you on the plot, I want to see if no new one dependent short footprints will remain in an RPS20 mutant, or an RPS10 mutant, or a ZNF-598 mutant, which could help answer the question if no new one recruitment requires multiple ubiquitinated sites, or just one, or even none. And so with that, I want to thank you guys for all coming here today, everybody in the lab for all their support, and then also our funding, and then I'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Parisa. That was a really great talk. Does anybody have any questions before we wrap things up?
I had one question, Parisa. I was wondering if you said there was fragments that were, what are they, no new independent or ubiquitin independent? Yeah, no new independent. So I was wondering if there's anything characteristic about those fragments that may suggest the type of endonuclease that may be causing them, such as, you know, bias of the ends or sequence specificity, things like that.
Yeah. So all the footprints there were captured with the same ends on the RNA. So it would have to be a similar nuclease to no new one. But we can alter our library prep steps to obtain different ends on RNAs too. So we can do that.
Thanks.
I had a question about the GFP signal that you're seeing. When you showed the bright worm, I didn't really notice any sub-regional differences in how much it was glowing. Maybe it was just overexposed. But then the intermediate ones that you showed have spots of, you know, brighter green. And do you see that when you de-repress this, that the signal is uniform, or are you seeing some mutants that
are you saying, like, comparing to the first worm I showed with no arginines?
Yeah, they're really
bright. The ones later.
I couldn't, they were on different slides, and I wanted to, like, think about, well, my main question was, does every mutant give a worm that has the same GFP distribution in it, meaning that the process you're looking at is altered the same way in all the cells of the worm, or does it seem like there's some tissue specificity in the process that you could pick up by seeing GFP in different places?
So the reason the worms with the arginine reporter look speckled like that is because of the T2A. So when UNC54 is cleaved off, the new N-terminus now is flag and 12 arginines, which, like, strangely is a nuclear localization signal.
Oh.
And so now I get nuclear localized GFP in all those worms, which you can't really see in the reporter alone. But once I have, like, the ZNF mutant, you can see the bright speckles just in the nucleus.
I see. Well, that's cool. Thanks.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't think it's like a cell specific thing.
Okay. Any more questions?
Did the was the ubiquitination of RPS 10 and 20, were those known about before? And you said that you're pretty sure that, at least for this ZNF unit, that it only targets those two?
Other groups pulled out RPS 10 and 20 as targets of ZNF. More so RPS 10, but they don't know how those proteins interface with anything else.
Are those linchpin? Maybe Harry could tell us. Are those linchpin in terms of regulating the assembly of the ribosome or disassembly? Or
I don't know about their roles in assembly. RPS10 could be important, considering that when I put a tag on it, it seems to be screwing with ribosomes somehow.
Hmm. Yeah, you might want to look on the structure.
Yeah, they're positioned near the mRNA entry tunnel. Uh-huh. So they're close together. So it would make sense if ZNF's ubiquitinating both of them.
And Harry, our local world expert, did you have a comment?
Well, I have to take a pass. We're talking about eukaryotic ribosomes.
Come on, they're all the same, right?
if RPS10 is URPS10 and not E.
RPS10 is E, and then RPS20 is URPS10. So I guess you don't know anything about my RPS10.
Yeah, that's what I was guessing. So
fair enough.
But not that much is known about assembly pathways in eukaryotic ribosome assembly anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't know.
Interesting.
All right, it looks like that might be the last question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks again, Parisa.
Thank you.
Yep, all right, well, thank you all again for coming today. I know the conditions are a little bit different, but I still look forward to seeing you all more or less and having a good discussion. So I appreciate all of that. And I guess we will see what happens next month. Have a good one, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for organizing. That's great.
Yep, no problem.
And thanks, Allie.
Thank you. Bye.